Laurie, Rio 2.
So, in October 1942, I moved on to Bedford College, London University, evacuated to Cambridge to read French and German. So I had my first two student years here, and I loved them too. It was a very different Cambridge from the one that Ted had known in the years before the war. Vast numbers of young men, of course, were not there. All the restrictions, the blackout, the whatever war service one could put in and so on, were in operation. Things like May balls were reduced to an absolute basic minimum. We shared premises with the University of Cambridge, who were extremely generous to us, and I felt that I was very well taught all the way through. The big snag was that I was reading modern languages. I was reading French and German, and of course one couldn't get to the countries concerned. But one really very interesting experience that I had as a direct result of that was that in one of the long acts, we were advised to go to a convent in Shropshire and stay there for as long as we could during the long vacation. The nuns had been evacuated from Alsace-Lorraine and were native speakers of both German and French. So I went to this wonderful place near Church Stretton, a lovely old Georgian mansion with rolling grounds going down to a lake at the bottom. And there I very rapidly became convinced that I had a vocation to be a nun. It was an amazingly impressive experience. It happened while I was there that all three of the ceremonials towards permanent vows took place. The young novices who had been there for 9 weeks took initial vows. And then at a later stage during that summer, a year later, the girls who had reached that stage took the next set of vows. And finally, 3 years later, in their convent career, the girls who had then been there for more than 4 years took the final vows. And the second set, to my amazement, was in the form of a fully-fledged marriage ceremony. White gown, wreath and veil, bouquets, a lot. And the third ceremony, it took the form of a burial service. By this time, the girls were dressed in black in their full habit, and I remember very clearly they lay down, face down, on the flagstones in the little chapel and took their permanent vows. And it was an unforgettable experience for me. It caused me to think a tremendous amount. My father had been a Roman Catholic. So that was one thing that happened in my university time. Another thing was that in due course I was invited by a tiny little runt of a man. I mean, but really tiny and unprepossessing. And he wouldn't have stood any chance whatsoever in any fighting uniform. Wrote me a letter, couched in Jane Austen phraseology, inviting, the charming Miss Bedwick to accompany him to a May ball and so and so, which I didn't do, I have to say. But altogether, it was tremendous fun. I lived in a house in Cambridge, of which nobody knows of the existence except those who've actually visited it. It stands on a tiny island created by a backwater from the River Cam, up in Newnham, and you go way to the end of the street and along a little stretch of mud road over a tiny wooden bridge, and there is this gorgeous house, Paradise House, on Paradise Island. It's lovely. And I lived there with a girl called Irene Crispin and a landlady who was one of the team who had helped on the splitting of the atom. She was a scientist. She was very prim, very proper, widowed, lived with her elderly mother in a house with a little housemaid of the kind who don't exist now. This girl did everything, cooking. cooking, cleaning, everything, the family's laundry, not ours. But they were extremely good to us.
What was her name?
Mrs. Griffith. And she had been married twice, and she had a son from each marriage. And the older son was a total eccentric, a brilliant scientist, following in his mother's tracks. And he lived very close by, and was called upon at frequent intervals to do fire watching duty in his university department. And he was married to a wife called Nan, who was a jolly kind of girl, and he adored her, and it was reciprocated. And on the nights when Hugh firewatched, Nan would come and sleep in our house. And in the morning, we'd all sit down to breakfast together, and he wouldn't crack his own egg. They had hens, of which more anon. Nan had to crack his egg for him, and she did it, you know, with great devotion. And he was, in many ways, a total nitwit, but very endearing. And the younger son at this time was at Arundel, and he had five cherished hens, which he adored during the vacations, and his mother looked after in the term time. And there came the point when, given the intensity of rationing, she couldn't find food for them. And she wrote to John and she said, "I am very sorry, but the hens will have to go. Will you let me know, as soon as it's convenient, which one first?" So a telegram arrived, telegram still being in existence in those days, saying, "Kill Turk, stop. Take photograph first." And so Turk was duly killed, and on the following Sunday, all the family, Hugh and Nan and Irene and old Mrs. I can't remember the old mother's name, but Mrs. Griffith and her mother and son sat round the table, and there was Turk on the carving dish, which was not a happy moment at all. Anyway, so I loved Cambridge. In my last year in Cambridge, which was 1944, the year of the Second Front, of course, we were given the option between committing ourselves to 5 years teaching, in which case we could have stayed on and completed our degree, or alternatively being directed into war work. And I knew that I didn't want to teach at the school level. I'm very happy to work with adults who have chosen to study, but I am not a born school teacher, and so I said no. And that meant that I took my German finals in 1944. Went home, was given absolutely no option as to where I went, used the intervening couple of weeks to do an absolute crash shorthand and typing course, which has stood me in wonderfully good stead ever since, and was directed to Bletchley Park.
Well, there's a lot I want you to tell me about Bletchley Beryl, but before we go on to that, was there any bombing in Cambridge during, you know, with the V1s, would it be V1s, V2 time there, 44?
Not to my knowledge at all. Amazingly, because Cambridge was surrounded by Air Force bases, both American and British, quite inevitably, because it was closer to the continent, and also because the terrain was flat and so on, there were Air Force bases of both kinds all round. But neither, I understand, was Heidelberg bombed. And I rather imagine that there must have been, even with someone like Hitler, a quid pro quo. I couldn't guarantee that, but it seemed amazing that that didn't happen. So no, we weren't bombed.
Right, well, what did you think of, you know, did you know anything when you were told you were directed to a place called Bletchley?
Yeah.
What did it mean to you?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. I'd never heard of it. I arrived and was taken. I had travelled through Bletchley, because coming from Stockport to Cambridge in those days, you came by rail to Bletchley and then transferred onto the little trundle line that stopped at every station between Bletchley and Cambridge. So I knew it existed, but I knew it as a railway junction. So I knew nothing about it, and I arrived and was taken, met at the station, taken by coach to Newport Pagnell, which in those days was a large village, small country town, and there 20 of us were billeted in the Swan Hotel at Newport Pagnell, where we slept on cockle beds in the ballroom. And that, in a way, it was marvellous, because we had company, we were thrown straight into it, and the other people there were delightful. In another way, it was hair-raising, because, as we very quickly discovered, Bletchley Park worked 24 hours a day, in three shifts, from 8 until 4, 4 until midnight, and then midnight until either 8 or 9, according to what you were doing. And consequently, there was constant toing and froing. So if you came off the midnight shift, somebody was moving out to go on to the next shift. And if you had done a night shift, it was terribly difficult to sleep in the daytime. So it had marked disadvantages. Anyway, at the earliest moment, we were taken into Bletchley Park, where we were fed through the security office, where we signed the Secrecy Act. And that became a regular feature. As you collected your salary, you were automatically signing the Secrecy Act again. My salary at the time was the epoch-making amount of £150 per year after 2 years at the university. But that wasn't the entire picture, because in course of time, and quite quickly, we were all put out to private billets. And I was sent to a small family by the name of Giles in, I remember very clearly, 25 Pickford Street, Newport Pagnell. There was Mrs. Giles, who would be in her 40s, white-haired, bespectacled, really a person with quite ferocious mien, but she was immensely kindly. And her husband, who was by no means the strong silent hero, but he was just very taciturn. He was a thick-set, stocky, totally uncommunicative labourer. And they had a little daughter. They had had a little daughter who had died at the age of 5 or 6, a year before the arrival of the surviving little daughter, Anne, who was very precious to them. It was a 2-up and 2-down terraced house. The only bath in the place was galvanised metal, which was stood on the floor in the scullery and could be filled from boiling kettles once a week. But for all the care that I was given, which was bed, breakfast and one main meal per day, I paid, on official arrangement, £1 per week. And in those days, of course, it was possible, because food was very inexpensive. There were fleets of buses in and around Buckinghamshire and Bedfordshire, which ferried to and fro to all the local villages, Wavendon, Wolvercote, out as far as Bedford. Hundreds and hundreds of wrens at one point were billeted in Woburn Abbey, which, to the best of my knowledge, had no central heating, was vast and vaulting and stone-floored and pestilentially cold. But these buses came and went all the time, because by the time I reached Bletchley Park, the era of the select nucleus that had been assembled very carefully in the months running up to the war was well over. That nucleus consisted of numbers of the most brilliant brains in the country. They were recruited from the universities, those from the academic staff and the undergraduate population. Many of them were mathematicians, linguists, dedicated chess players, crossword puzzle experts, and so on. But they were utterly and totally brilliant. As the television series showed, people like Alan Turing and so on, they were people of genius, and interestingly, not only men. And among those early intakes were young women from some of the best families in the country, some of whom did amazingly constructive work actually on the code-breaking front. I think in my own mind, possibly reasons for their recruitment, as well as linguistic qualifications, you know, girls who'd been to finishing schools in Switzerland and so on, but I think also it was a question of the acute need for secrecy and the sense of integrity and honour and loyalty. By the time I reached Bletchley Park, with the breaking of the regular breaking of the Enigma codes and all the other codes that came through Bletchley, the numbers had increased from 30, 40 in the first instance to 10,000. Civilians and service people, canteen staff, drivers from the coaches, cleaners. I don't know how they managed about cleaning, because the contents of the huts in which the work was done was absolutely top secret view much of the time. But the quite amazing thing in today's world, where everything from the names of MI5 and MI6 agents right through to the contents of the budget are routinely divulged to the media, the secret was kept with 10,000 plus people there. Germany never knew right through the war what Bletchley Park was doing. The absolute brilliant achievements were made by the top rankers. The vast recruitment campaign came because as sideswipes from their achievements and from the possibility of breaking these codes, it arose that in many instances on the Enigma machine, in order to break the code, there would be up to 150 3 noughts, 3 noughts, and 3 noughts options to be gone through before they actually hit on the one that had to be broken. And they changed frequently because of the ease. I think probably most people in this country know now what the setup of the Enigma machine was. It was like a cross between an old-fashioned cash machine in a store and a complicated typewriter. And on this machine, there were, at a fairly high level, there were initially 3 cogwheels round the outside of which were letters, each one, and they could move independently so that you could make any combination you want of letters. In front of that was a battery of keys through which letters were tapped in by the cipher clerk, and in front of that again there were a series of what were called plugs, which could be crossed and intersected with each other in order further to complicate the combinations that the wheels were producing. And the Germans were convinced that they had developed Enigma to a point where it was totally unbreakable. And the fact that the likes of Alan Turing and his colleagues broke it was mind-blowingly amazing. It really was. In the wake of that came the need to test all these thousands and thousands of options daily in order to get on to the day's messages, which were coming through in floods. And in order to do that, they used huge numbers of girls on outstations receiving the messages to do the routine work. And within Bletchley Park, huge numbers of men and women actually to go through the motions of putting the options through the great Colossus computer. In none of this, do I say regretfully, did I have a major part, none. By the time I came in the summer of 1944, I was very much one of the hoi polloi. I was accredited to Naval Hut 7, Section 6, under the command of one Lieutenant Commander Geoffrey Tandy. R-N-V-R.
Tandy.
T-A-N-D-Y.
And that's Geoffrey with a J, is it?
With a G.
G.
G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y. Tandy. He actually, in civilian life, was Dr. Tandy. But his doctorate was not in cryptograms, but in cryptogams, which is the study of mosses and ferns and so on. And whether that was a tactical error or whether he was recruited for other skills, I don't know. I have to say he was something of an empire building. I don't imagine he ever even knew of my existence. He was very rank conscious. We have it precious. But I'm quite convinced that his section did a good job in its way. It was a very mixed section, and its work was, as codes came in and were decrypted and translated by the Z-Watch, which was the nerve center of the whole thing, repeatedly and increasingly, terminology and technical and other details would arise which were unfamiliar and which occurred in no known dictionaries. Those things came down to us, as did all manner of captured material. And you see, by 1944, when I went in, the Second Front was already a couple of months underway. And so the captured document situation and captured equipment situation was a thriving business. And our job was to go through all these things and pick out and translate and produce equivalents for unknown words and concepts and give details of all the technical functioning, design, engineering, and so on that we could pick up about them, and all this was fed into a monstrous index which could then be consulted by the code breakers and the Z-Watch translators and so on and so forth.
Could you give an example of one such term and the equivalent you might have found? I know this might be a difficult thing to suddenly confront
it's
you
long
with.
Way to yes.
Exactly. Yes.
But for example, a group of us was taken up to the East London docks and actually taken over a captured German submarine. And we went through it in minute detail. And they had, the various things that came into operation during the war. Certainly radar. And I'm trying to remember the submarine attachment, which was a marked advance on the old periscope, which could survey the sea. And that kind of thing. The V-bombs, the V-1 and 2 bombs, came our way for description. We were actually drawing material out of technical captured documents and equipment and so on, and translating in such a way we hoped that the recipients of our translations could actually comprehend how the thing worked, how it was designed, what the countermeasures were likely to be. And in this connection, among other people in Naval Section 6, was Professor Leonard Forster, Professor of German from Cambridge University. There were actually two Cambridge professors there. And he was a delightful person who came back after the war to take up his chair. He was married to a German wife, and he was a spare, rather ascetic-looking academic, not all that big, and in a little office which demanded access through the office in which I worked, there was one Hubert Potter Earl, who was an American naval officer. He was large and St. Bernard puppy-like, very recently married, pining for his new bride, and from time to time joining forces with Leonard Forster on the most amazing excursions. Hubert was naval, Leonard was civilian, and so for these occasions Leonard had to borrow naval uniform, because otherwise he could have been shot as a spy had he ever been discovered. And how it was done, I will never know, because one of the main facets of life at Bletchley was you never asked questions. Everything worked on a need-to-know basis. You never, by any chance, popped along the corridor to another section to talk to your mate. Never. There was always a ripple of excitement when enigma was broken for the day. That somehow percolated, but that was really the extent of it. Anyway, these two would be dropped. Forster in a uniform which was usually five sizes too big for him, you know, turned up at the ankles and at the sleeves. And they would be dropped ahead of the British invading forces in German territory. And there they would assemble, and again I cannot imagine how, and bring back technical specifications, manufacturing instructions, operating manuals, again V1 and V2 rockets, mines, and this kind of thing. How they did it, I do not know. And at that time, clearly the amount, the bulk of stuff coming into us was huge, really huge. And on a very much smaller scale, there was a Japanese unit in the section. Most of the work on Japanese was done in America and in the Far East. But there was this small select section in Bletchley. And one of the most striking characters in it was a girl called Carmen Blacker. My age, from a very distinguished family, beautiful, tall, slender, almost Medea-like, with black hair, rather constrictive manner of speech. I think she was probably basically terribly shy. And she was about my own age. She was picked up at the School of African and Oriental Studies as an outstandingly brilliant learner of Japanese and brought to Bletchley. And she loathed it. She absolutely loathed it. She felt frustrated and so on because they were getting the side swipes of the Japanese war. And she used to our intense delight to beguile the moments when the work was not pressing by painting the most gorgeous dragons which adorned the walls of the office, kind of thing.